of fire, shrieking as they burn, lewd and naked underneath the flames. And you shall see your little children weeping, weeping till their eyes do melt and slide like jelly down their faces, till their pink flesh falls black and crackling from their bones. The stranger comes, he comes, he comes, to scourge us for our sins. Prayers cannot stay his wrath, no more than tears can quench the flame of dragons. Only blood can do that. Your blood, my blood, their blood! Then he raised his right arm and jabbed the stump of his missing hand at Rhaenys's hill behind him, at the dragon pit, black against the stars. There the demons dwell, up there! Fire and blood! Blood and fire! This is their city. If you would make it yours, first must you destroy them. If you would cleanse yourself of sin, first must you bathe in dragon's blood. For only blood can quench the fires of hell. From 10,000 throats a cry went up. Kill them! Kill them! And like some vast beast with 10,000 legs, the lambs began to move, shoving and pushing, waving their torches, brandishing swords and knives and other cruder weapons, walking and running through the streets and alleys toward the dragon pit. Some thought better and slipped away to home, but for every man who left, three more appeared to join these dragon slayers. By the time they reached the Hill of Rhaenys, their numbers had doubled. High atop Aegon's high hill across the city, Mushroom watched the attack unfold from the roof of Maegor's Holdfast with the Queen, her sons, and members of her court. The night was black and overcast, the torches so numerous that it was as if all the stars had come down from the sky to storm the dragon pit, the fool says. As soon as word had reached her that the shepherd's savage flock was on the march, Rhaenyra sent riders to Ser Balon at the old gate and Ser Garth at the dragon gate, commanding them to disperse the lambs, seize the shepherd, and defend the royal dragons. But with the city in such turmoil, it was far from certain that the riders had won through. Even if they had, what loyal gold cloaks remained were too few to have any hope of success. Her Grace had as well commanded them to halt the black water in its flow, says Mushroom. When Prince Joffrey pleaded with his mother to let him ride forth with their own knights and those from White Harbour, the Queen refused. If they take that hill, this one will be next, she said. We will need every sword here to defend the castle. They will kill the dragons, Prince Joffrey said, anguished. Or the dragons will kill them, his mother said, unmoved. Let them burn. The realm will not long miss them. Mother, what if they kill Taraxes? The young prince said. The queen did not believe it. They are vermin, drunks and fools and gutter rats. One taste of dragon flame and they will run. At that the fool Mushroom spoke up, saying, Drunks they may be, but a drunken man knows not fear. Fools, aye, but a fool can kill a king. Rats, that too. But 1,000 rats can bring down a bear. I saw it happen once, down there in Flea Bottom. This time Queen Rhaenyra did not laugh. Bidding her fool to hold his tongue or lose it, Her Grace turned back to the parapets. Only Mushroom saw Prince Joffrey go sulking off, if his testimony can be believed, and Mushroom had been told to hold his tongue. It was only when the watchers on the roof heard Sirax roar that the prince's absence was noted. That was too late. No, the queen was heard to say. I forbid it! I forbid it! But even as she spoke, her dragon flapped up from the yard, perched for half a heartbeat atop the castle battlements, then launched herself into the night, with the queen's son clinging to her back, a sword in hand. After him! Rhaenyra shouted. All of you, every man, every boy, to horse! To horse! Go after him! Bring him back! Bring him back! He does not know! My son! My sweet, my son! 7 men did ride down from the Red Keep that night into the madness of the city. Monken tells us they were men of honour, duty-bound to obey their queen's commands. Septon Eustace would have us believe that their hearts had been touched by a mother's love for her son. Mushroom names them dolts and dastards, eager for some rich reward, and too dull to believe that they might die. For once it may be that all 3 of our chroniclers have the truth of it. at least in part. Our Septon, our Maester and our Fool, to agree upon their names. The seven who rode were Sir Medric Manderley, the heir to White Harbour, Sir Loreth Lansdale and Sir Harold Dark, Knights of the Queen's Guard, Sir Harmon of the Reeds, called Iron Banger, Sir Giles Ironwood, an exiled knight from Dawn, Sir William Royce, armed with the famed Valyrian sword Lamentation, and Sir Glendon Good, Lord Commander of the Queen's Guard. Six squires, eight gold cloaks, and 20 men-at-arms rode with the seven champions as well, but their names, alas, have not come down to us. Many a singer has made many a song of the Ride of the Seven, and many a tale has been told of the perils they faced as they fought their way across the city, whilst King's Landing burned around them and the alleys of Fleabottom ran red with blood. Certain of those songs even have some truth to them, but it is beyond our purview to recount them here. Songs are sung of Prince Joffrey's last flight as well. Some singers can find glory even in a privy, Mushroom tells us, but it takes a fool to speak the truth. Though we cannot doubt the prince's courage, his act was one of folly. We shall not pretend to any understanding of the bond between dragon and dragon rider. Wiser heads have pondered that mystery for centuries. We do know, however, that dragons are not horses to be ridden by any man who throws a saddle on their back. Cyrax was the queen's dragon. She had never known another rider. Though Prince Joffrey was known to her by sight and scent, a familiar presence whose fumbling at her chains excited no alarm, the great yellow she-dragon wanted no part of him astride her. In his haste to be away before he could be stopped, the prince had vaulted onto Cyrax without benefit of saddle or whip. His intent, we must presume, was either to fly Cyrax into battle or, more likely, to cross the city to the dragon pit and his own Taraxes. Mayhaps he meant to loose the other pit dragons as well. Joffrey never reached the Hill of Rhaenys. Once in the air, Cyrax twisted beneath him, fighting to be free of this unfamiliar rider. And from below, stones and spears and arrows flew at him from the hands of the shepherd's blood-soaked lambs, maddening the dragon even further. 200 feet above Fleabottom, Prince Joffrey slid from the dragon's back and plunged to the earth. Near a juncture where five alleys came together, the prince's fall came to its bloody end. He crashed first onto a steep-pitched roof before rolling off to fall another 40 feet amidst a shower of broken tiles. We are told that the fall broke his back, that shards of slate rained down upon him like knives, that his own sword tore loose of his hand and pierced him through the belly. In Fleabottom, men still speak of a candlemaker's daughter named Robin, who cradled the broken prince in her arms and gave him comfort as he died. But there is more of legend than of history in that tale. "Mother, forgive me," Joffrey supposedly said with his last breath, though men still argue whether he was speaking of his mother, the queen, or praying to the mother above. Thus perished Joffrey Valerian, Prince of Dragonstone and heir to the Iron Throne, the last of Queen Rhaenyra's sons by Laenor Valerian, or the last of her bastards by Sir Harwin Strong, depending on which truth one chooses to believe. The mob was not long in falling on his corpse. The candlemaker's daughter Robin, if she ever existed, was driven off. Looters tore the boots from the prince's feet and the sword from his belly, then stripped him of his fine, blood-stained clothes. Others, still more savage, began ripping at his body. Both of his hands were cut off, so the scum of the street might claim the rings on his fingers. The prince's right foot was hacked through at the ankle, and a butcher's apprentice was sawing at his neck to claim his head, when the seven who rode came thundering up. There, amidst the stinks of Fleabottom, a battle was waged in the mud and blood for possession of Prince Joffrey's body. The queen's knights at last reclaimed the boy's remains, save for his missing foot, though three of the seven fell in the fighting. The Dornishman, Sir Giles Ironwood, was pulled from his horse and bludgeoned to death, whilst Sir William Royce was felled by a man who leapt down from a rooftop to land upon his back. His famed sword, Lamentation, was torn from his hand and carried off, never to be found again. Most grievous of all was the fate of Sir Glendon Good, attacked from behind by a man with a torch who set his long white cloak afire. As the flames licked at his back, his horse reared in terror and threw him, and the mob swarmed over him, tearing him to pieces. Only 20 years of age, Sir Glendon had been Lord Commander of the Queen's Guard for less than a day. And even as blood flowed in the alleys of Flea Bottom, another battle raged round the Dragon Pit above, atop the Hill of Rainies. Mushroom was not wrong. Swarms of starving rats do indeed bring down bulls and bears and lions when there are enough of them. No matter how many the bull or bear might kill, there are always more, biting at the great beast's legs, clinging to its belly, running up its back. So it was that night. The shepherd's rats were armed with spears, long axes, spiked clubs, and 60 other kinds of weapons, including both longbows and crossbows. Gold cloaks from the Dragon Gate, obedient to the Queen's command, issued forth from their barracks to defend the hill, but found themselves unable to cut through the mobs and turned back, whilst the messenger sent to the old gate never arrived. The Dragon Pit had its own contingent of guards, the Dragon Keepers, but those proud warriors were only 77 in number, and fewer than 50 had the watch that night. Though their swords drank deep of the blood of the attackers, the numbers were against them. When the shepherd's lambs smashed through the doors, the towering main gates, sheathed in bronze and iron, were too strong to assault, but the building had a score of lesser entrances, and came clambering through windows, the Dragon Keepers were overwhelmed, and soon slaughtered. Mayhaps the attackers hoped to take the dragons within whilst they slept, but the clangor of the assault made that impossible. Those who lived to tell tales afterward speak of shouts and screams, the smell of blood in the air, the splintering of oak and iron doors beneath crude rams, and the blows of countless axes. Seldom have so many men rushed so eagerly onto their funeral pyres, Grand Maester Monken wrote, but a madness was upon them. There were 4 dragons housed within the Dragon Pit. By the time the first of the attackers came pouring out onto the sands, all 4 were roused, awake, and angry. No 2 chronicles agree on how many men and women died that night beneath the Dragon Pit's great dome. 200 or 2,000, be that as it may. For every man who perished, 10 suffered burns and yet survived. Trapped within the pit, hemmed in by walls and dome and bound by heavy chains, the dragons could not fly away, or use their wings to evade attacks and swoop down on their foes. Instead, they fought with horns and claws and teeth, turning this way and that like bulls in a flea-bottom rat pit. But these bulls could breathe fire. The Dragon Pit was transformed into a fiery hell, where burning men staggered screaming through the smoke, the flesh sloughing from their blackened bones, writes Septon Eustace. But for every man who died, 10 more appeared, shouting that the dragons must needs die. One by one, they did. Trikos was the first dragon to succumb, slain by a woodsman known as Hob the Hewer, who leapt onto her neck, driving his axe down into the beast's skull as Trikos roared and twisted, trying to throw him off. 7 blows did Hob deliver with his legs locked round the dragon's neck, and each time his axe came down he roared out the name of one of the 7. It was the 7th blow, the stranger's blow, that slew the dragon, crashing through scale and bones into the beast's brain, if Eustace is to be believed. Morgul, it is written, was slain by the Burning Knight, a huge brute of a man in heavy armour who rushed headlong into the dragon's flame with spear in hand, thrusting its point into the beast's eye repeatedly, even as the dragon flame melted the steel plate that encased him and devoured the flesh within. Prince Joffrey's Taraxes retreated back into his lair, we are told, roasting so many would-be dragon slayers as they rushed after him, that its entrance was soon made impassable by their corpses. But it must be recalled that each of these man-made caves had 2 entrances, one fronting onto the sands of the pit, the other opening onto the hillside. It was the shepherd himself who directed his followers to break through the back door. 100s did, howling through the smoke with swords and spears and axes. As Taraxes turned, his chains fouled, entangling him in a web of steel that fatally limited his movement. Half a dozen men, and one woman would later claim to have dealt the dragon the mortal blow. Like his master, Taraxes suffered further indignity even in death, as the shepherd's followers sliced the membranes from his wings and tore them into ragged strips to fashion dragon-skin cloaks. The last of the four pit dragons did not die so easily. Legend has it that Dreamfire had broken free of two of her chains at Queen Helena's death. The remaining bonds she burst now, tearing the stanchions from the walls as the mob rushed her, then plunging into them with tooth and claw, ripping men apart and tearing off their limbs even as she loosed her terrible fires. As others closed about her, she took wing, circling the cavernous interior of the dragon pit and swooping down to attack the men below. Taraxes, Shrikos, and Morgul killed scores, there can be little doubt. But Dreamfire slew more than all three of them combined. Hundreds fled in terror from her flames. But hundreds more, drunk or mad or possessed of the warrior's own courage, pushed through to the attack. Even at the apex of the dome, the dragon was within easy reach of archer and crossbowman, and arrows and quarrels flew at Dreamfire wherever she went, at such close range that some few even punched through her scales. Whenever she lighted, men swarmed to the attack, driving her back into the air. Twice the dragon flew at the dragon pit's great bronze gates, only to find them closed and barred and defended by ranks of spears. Unable to flee, Dreamfire returned to the attack, savaging her tormentors until the sands of the pit were strewn with charred corpses, and the very air was thick with smoke and the smell of burned flesh, yet still the spears and arrows flew. The end came when a crossbow bolt nicked one of the dragon's eyes. Half blind, and maddened by a dozen lesser wounds, Dreamfire spread her wings and flew straight up at the great dome above in a last desperate attempt to break into the open sky. Already weakened by blasts of dragon flame, the dome cracked under the force of impact, and a moment later half of it came tumbling down, crushing both dragon and dragon slayers under tons of broken stone and rubble. The storming of the dragon pit was done. Four of the Targaryen dragons lay dead, though at hideous cost. Yet the shepherd was not yet triumphant, for the queen's own dragon remained alive and free. And as the burned and bloody survivors of the carnage in the pit came stumbling from the smoking ruins, Cyrax descended upon them from above. Mushroom was amongst those watching with Queen Rhaenyra on the roof of Maegor's Holdfast. A thousand shrieks and shouts echoed across the city, mingling with the dragon's roar, he tells us. Atop the hill of Rhaenys, the dragon pit wore a crown of yellow fire, burning so bright it seemed as if the sun was rising. Even the queen trembled as she watched, the tears glistening on her cheeks. Never have I seen a sight more terrible, more glorious. Many of the queen's companions on the rooftop fled, the dwarf tells us, fearing that the fires would soon engulf the entire city, even the Red Keep atop Aegon's high hill. Others took themselves to the castle sept to pray for deliverance. Rhaenyra herself wrapped her arms about her last living son, Aegon the Younger, clutching him fiercely to her bosom. Nor would she loose her hold upon him until that dread moment when Cyrax fell. Unchained and riderless, Cyrax might have easily flown away from the madness. The sky was hers. She could have returned to the Red Keep, left the city entirely, taken wing for Dragonstone. Was it the noise and fire that drew her to the Hill of Rhaenys? The roars and screams of the dying dragons? The smell of burning flesh? We cannot know, no more than we can know why Cyrax chose to descend upon the shepherd's mobs, rending them with tooth and claw and devouring dozens, when she might as easily have rained fire on them from above, for in the sky no man could have harmed her. We can only report what happened, as Mushroom, Septon Eustace, and Grand Maester Munkin have set it down for us. Many a conflicting tale is told of the death of the Queen's dragon. Munkin credits Hob the Hewer and his axe, though this is almost certainly mistaken. Could the same man truly have slain two dragons on the same night and in the same manner? Some speak of an unnamed spearman, a blood-soaked giant, who leapt from the dragon pit's broken dome onto the dragon's back. Others relate how a knight named Sir Warwick Wheaton slashed a wing from Cyrax with a Valyrian steel sword, Lamentation, most like. A crossbowman named Bean would claim the kill afterward, boasting of it in many a wine sink and tavern, until one of the Queen's loyalists grew tired of his wagging tongue and cut it out. Possibly all these worthies, save Hob, played some role in the dragon's demise. But the tale most oft heard in King's Landing named the shepherd himself as the dragon slayer. As others fled, the story went, the one-handed prophet stood fearless and alone against the ravening beast, calling on the seven for succour, till the warrior himself took form 30 feet tall. In his hand was a black blade made of smoke that turned to steel as he swung it, cleaving the head of Syrax from her body. And so the tale was told, even by Septon Eustace in his account of these dark days, and so the singers sang for many years thereafter. The loss of both her dragon and her son left Rhaenyra Targaryen ashen and inconsolable, Mushroom tells us. Attended only by the fool, she retreated to her chambers, whilst her counsellors conferred. King's Landing was lost, all agreed. They must needs abandon the city. Reluctantly, her grace was persuaded to leave the next day at dawn. With the Mudgate in the hands of her foes, and all the ships along the river burned or sunk, Rhaenyra and a small band of followers slipped out through the Dragon Gate, intending to make their way up the coast to Duskendale. With her rode the brothers Manderly, 4 surviving Queensguard, Sir Balon Birch, and 20 gold cloaks, 4 of the Queen's ladies-in-waiting, and her last surviving son, Aegon the Younger. Mushroom remained behind, along with other members of the court, amongst them Lady Misery and Septon Eustace. Sir Garth, the Harelip, captain of the gold cloaks at the Dragon Gate, was charged with the defence of the castle, a task for which the Harelip proved to have little appetite. Her Grace had not been gone half a day when Sir Perkin the Flea and his gutter knights appeared outside the gates, demanding that the castle yield. Though outnumbered 10-1, the Queen's garrison might still have resisted. But Sir Garth chose instead to strike Rhaenyra's banners, open his gates, and trust to the mercy of the foe. The Flea proved to have no mercy. Garth the Harelip was dragged before him and beheaded, along with 20 other knights still loyal to the Queen, amongst them Sir Harmon of the Reeds, the Ironbanger, who had been one of the 7 who rode. Nor was the mistress of Whisperers, Lady Miseria of Lys, spared on account of her sex. Taken whilst attempting to flee, the White Worm was whipped naked through the city, from the Red Keep to the Gate of the Gods. If she were still alive by the time they reached the gate, Sir Perkin promised, she would be spared and allowed to go. She made it only half that distance, dying on the cobblestones with hardly a patch of her pale white skin left upon her back. Septon Eustace feared for his own life. "Only the mother's mercy saved me," he writes, though it seems more likely that Sir Perkin did not wish to provoke the enmity of the faith. The Flea also freed all the prisoners found in the dungeons below the castle, amongst them Grand Maester Orwyle and the Sea Snake, Lord Corlys Valerian. Both were on hand the next day to bear witness as Sir Perkin's gangling squire Tristane mounted the Iron Throne. So too was the Queen Dowager, Alicent of House Hightower. Down in the black cells, Sir Perkin's men even found King Aegon's former master of coin, Sir Tyland Lannister, still alive. Though Rhaenyra's torturers had blinded him, pulled out his fingernails and toenails, cut off his ears, and relieved him of his manhood. King Aegon's master of whisperers, Larys Strong the Clubfoot, fared much better. The Lord of Harrenhal emerged intact from wherever he had been hiding. Like a man risen from the grave, he came striding through the halls of the Red Keep as if he had never left them, to be greeted warmly by Sir Perkin the Flea, and take a place of honour at the side of his new king. The Queen's flight brought no peace to King's Landing. 3 kings reigned over the city, each on his own hill, yet for their unfortunate subjects there was no law, no justice, no protection, says the true telling. No man's home was safe, nor any maiden's virtue. This chaos endured for more than a moon's turn. Maesters and other scholars writing of this time oft take their cue from Monken, and speak of the Moon of the 3 Kings, Other scholars prefer the Moon of Madness. But this is a misnomer, as the shepherd never claimed kingship, styling himself a simple son of the Seven. Yet it cannot be denied that he held sway over tens of thousands from the ruins of the Dragon Pit. The heads of the five dragons that his followers had slain had been set up on posts, and every night the shepherd would appear amongst them to preach. With the dragons dead, and the threat of immolation no longer imminent, the prophet turned his wrath upon the high-born and wealthy. Only the poor and humble would ever see the halls of the gods, he declared. Lords and knights and rich men would be cast down in their pride and avarice to hell. "Cast off your silks and satins, and clothe your nakedness in rough-spun robes," he told his followers. "Throw away your shoes, and walk barefoot through the world as the Father made you." Thousands obeyed. But thousands more turned away, and each night the crowds that came to hear the prophet grew smaller. At the other end of the Street of the Sisters, Gaemon Palehair's queer kingdom blossomed atop Visenya's hill. The court of this 4-year-old bastard king was made up of whores, mummers, and thieves, whilst gangs of ruffians, sellswords, and drunkards defended his rule. One decree after another came down from the House of Kisses, where the child king had his seat, each more outrageous than the last. Gaemon decreed that girls should henceforth be equal with boys in matter of inheritance, that the poor be given bread and beer in times of famine, that men who had lost limbs in war must afterward be fed and housed by whichever lord they had been fighting for when the loss took place. Gaemon decreed that husbands who beat their wives should themselves be beaten, irrespective of what the wives had done to warrant such chastisement. These edicts were almost certainly the work of a Dornish whore named Sylvenna Sand, reputedly the paramour of the little king's mother Essie, if Mushroom is to be believed. Royal decrees also issued forth from atop Aegon's high hill where Sir Perkin's catspaw Tristane sat the Iron Throne, but those were of a very different nature. The Squire King began by repealing Queen Rhaenyra's unpopular taxes and dividing the coin in the royal treasury amongst his own followers. He followed that with a general cancellation of debt, raised 60 of his gutter knights to the ranks of the nobility, and answered King Gaemon's promise of free bread and beer for the starving by granting the poor the right to take rabbits, hares, and deer from the Kingswood as well, though not elk nor boar. All the while, Sir Perkin the Flea was recruiting scores of surviving gold cloaks to Tristane's banner. With their swords he took control of the Dragon Gate, the King's Gate, and the Lion Gate, giving him 4 of the city's 7 gates and more than half of the towers along its walls. In the early days after the queen's flight, the shepherd was by far the most powerful of the city's 3 kings. But as the nights passed, the number of his followers continued to dwindle. "The small folk of the city woke as if from a bad dream," Septon Eustace wrote, "and like sinners waking, cold and sober after a night of drunken debauchery and revel, they turned away in shame, hiding their faces from one another and hoping to forget." Though the dragons were dead and the queen fled, such was the power of the Iron Throne that the commons still looked to the Red Keep when hungry or afraid. So as the power of the shepherd waned on the Hill of Rhaenys, the power of King Tristane Truefire, as he now styled himself, waxed atop Aegon's high hill. Much and more was happening at Tumbleton as well, and it is there we must next turn our gaze. As word of the unrest at King's Landing reached Prince Daeron's host, many younger lords grew anxious to advance upon the city at once. Chief amongst them were Sir John Roxton, Sir Roger Corn, and Lord Unwin Peake. But Sir Hubert Hightower counselled caution, and the 2 betrayers refused to join any attack unless their own demands were met. Orthwhite, it will be recalled, wished to be granted the great castle of Highgarden, with all its lands and incomes, whilst Hard Hugh Hammer desired nothing less than a crown for himself. These conflicts came to a boil when Tumbleton learned belatedly of Aemon Targaryen's death at Harrenhal. King Aegon II had not been seen nor heard from since the fall of King's Landing to his half-sister Rhaenyra, and there were many who feared that the queen had put him secretly to death, concealing the corpse so as not to be condemned as a kinslayer. With his brother Aemon slain as well, the Greens found themselves kingless and leaderless. Prince Daron stood next in the line of succession. Lord Peak declared that the boy should be proclaimed as Prince of Dragonstone at once. Others, believing Aegon II dead, wished to crown him king. The two betrayers felt the need of a king as well, but Daron Targaryen was not the king they wanted. "We need a strong man to lead us, not a boy," declared Hard Hugh Hammer. "The throne should be mine." When bold John Roxton demanded to know by what right he presumed to name himself a king, Lord Hammer answered, "The same right as the conqueror, a dragon." And truly, with Vhagar dead at last, the oldest and largest living dragon in all Westeros was Vermithor, once the mount of the old king, now that of Hard Hugh the Bastard. Vermithor was thrice the size of Prince Daron's she-dragon Tessarion. No man who glimpsed them together could fail to see that Vermithor was a far more fearsome beast. Though Hammer's ambition was unseemly in one born so low, the bastard undeniably possessed some Targaryen blood and had proved himself fierce in battle and open-handed to those who followed him, displaying the sort of largesse that draws men to leaders as a corpse draws flies. They were the worst sort of men, to be sure, sellswords, robber knights, and like rabble, men of tainted blood and uncertain birth, who loved battle for its own sake and lived for rapine and plunder. Many had heard the prophecy that the hammer would smash the dragon and took it to mean that Hard Hugh's triumph was foreordained. The lords and knights of Old Town and the Reach were offended by the arrogance of the betrayer's claim, however, and none more so than Prince Daron Targaryen himself, who grew so wroth that he threw a cup of wine into Hard Hugh's face. Whilst Lord White shrugged this off as a waste of good wine, Lord Hammer said, "Little boys should be more manly when men are speaking. I think your father did not beat you often enough. Take care I do not make up for his lack." The two betrayers took their leave together and began to make plans for Hammer's coronation. When seen the next day, Hard Hugh was wearing a crown of black iron, to the fury of Prince Daron and his true-born lords and knights. One such Sir Roger Corne made so bold as to knock the crown off Hammer's head. "A crown does not make a man a king," he said. "You should wear a horseshoe on your head, blacksmith." It was a foolish thing to do. Lord Hugh was not amused. At his command, his men forced Sir Roger to the ground, whereupon the blacksmith's bastard nailed not one, but three horseshoes to the knight's skull. When Corne's friends tried to intervene, daggers were drawn and swords unsheathed, leaving three men dead and a dozen wounded. That was more than Prince Daron's loyalist lords were prepared to suffer. Lord Unwin Peak and a somewhat reluctant Hobart Hightower summoned 11 other lords and landed knights to a secret council in the cellar of a Tumbleton Inn to discuss what might be done to curb the arrogance of the base-born dragon riders. The plotters agreed that it would be a simple matter to dispose of White, who was drunk more oft than not, and had never shown any great prowess at arms. Hammer posed a greater danger, for of late he was surrounded day and night by lickspittles, camp followers, and sellswords eager for his favour. It would serve them little to kill White and leave Hammer alive, Lord Peak pointed out. Hard Hugh must needs die first. Long and loud were the arguments in the inn beneath the sign reading, "The Bloody Caltrops," as the lords discussed how this might best be accomplished. "Any man can be killed," declared Sir Hobart Hightower, "but what of the dragons?" "Given the turmoil at King's Landing," Sir Tyler Norcross said, "Tessarion alone should be enough to allow them to retake the Iron Throne." Lord Peak replied that victory would be a deal more certain with Vermithor and Silverwing. Mark Ambrose suggested that they take the city first, then dispose of White and Hammer after victory had been secured. But Richard Roddan insisted such a course would be dishonourable. "We cannot ask these men to shed blood with us, then kill them." Bold John Roxton settled the dispute. "We kill the bastards now," he said. "Afterward, let the bravest of us claim their dragons and fly them into battle." No man in that cellar doubted that Roxton was speaking of himself. Though Prince Daron was not present at the council, the Caltrops, as the conspiracies became known, were loath to proceed without his consent and blessing. Owen Fossoway, Lord of Cider Hall, was dispatched under cover of darkness to wake the prince and bring him to the cellar, that the plotters might inform him of their plans. Nor did the once gentle prince hesitate when Lord Unwin Peak presented him with warrants for the execution of Hard Hugh Hammer and Ulf White, but eagerly affixed his seal. Men may plot and plan and scheme, but they had best pray as well, for no plan made by man has ever withstood the whims of the gods above. 2 days later, on the very day the Caltrops planned to strike, Tumbleton woke in the black of night to screams and shouts. Outside the town walls, the camps were burning. Columns of armoured knights were pouring in from north and west, wreaking slaughter. The clouds were raining arrows, and a dragon was swooping down upon them, terrible and fierce. Thus began the second Battle of Tumbleton. The dragon was Sea Smoke. His rider, Sir Adam Valerian, determined to prove that not all bastards need be turncloaks. How better to do that than by retaking Tumbleton from the two betrayers, whose treason had stained him? Singers say Sir Adam had flown from King's Landing to the God's Eye, where he landed on the sacred Isle of Faces and took counsel with the Green Man. The scholar must confine himself to known fact, and what we know is that Sir Adam flew far and fast, descending on castles great and small whose lords were loyal to the queen, to piece together an army. Many a battle and skirmish had already been fought in the lands watered by the Trident, and there was scarce a keep or village that had not paid its due in blood. But Adam Valerian was relentless and determined and glib of tongue, and the Riverlords knew much and more of the horrors that had befallen Tumbleton. By the time Sir Adam was ready to descend on Tumbleton, he had near 4,000 men at his back. Benjicot Blackwood, the 12-year-old Lord of Raventree, had come forth, as had the widowed Sabitha Frey, Lady of the Twins, with her father and brothers of House Viperon, Lords Stanton Piper, Joseph Smallwood, Derek Darry and Lionel Deddings had scraped together fresh levies of greybeards and green boys, though all had suffered grievous losses in the autumn's battles. Hugo Vance, the young Lord of Wayfarer's Rest, had come with 300 of his own men, plus Black Trombo's Meerish sellswords. Most notably of all, House Tully had joined the war. Sea Smoke's descent upon River Run had at last persuaded that reluctant warrior Sir Elmo Tully to call his banners for the Queen, in defiance of the wishes of his bedridden grandsire, Lord Grover. "A dragon in one's courtyard does wonders to resolve one's doubts," Sir Elmo is reported to have said. The great host encamped about the walls of Tumbleton outnumbered the attackers, but they had been too long in one place. Their discipline had grown lax, drunkenness was endemic in the camp, Grand Maester Monken says, and disease had taken root as well. The death of Lord Ormond Hightower had left them without a leader, and the lords who wished to command in his place were at odds with one another. So intent were they upon their own conflicts and rivalries that they had all but forgotten their true foes. Sir Adam's night attack took them completely unawares. Before the men of Prince Darren's army even knew they were in a battle, the enemy was amongst them, cutting them down as they staggered from their tents, as they were saddling their horses, struggling to don their armour, buckling their sword belts. Most devastating of all was the dragon. Sea Smoke came swooping down again and yet again, breathing flame. 100 tents were soon afire, even the splendid silken pavilions of Sir Hobart Hightower, Lord Unwin Peak, and Prince Steron himself. Nor was the town of Tumbleton reprieved. Those shops and homes and septs that had been spared the first time were engulfed in dragon flame. Daeron Targaryen was in his tent asleep when the attack began. Ulf White was inside Tumbleton, sleeping off a night of drinking at an inn called the Bawdy Badger that he had taken for his own. Hard Hugh Hammer was within the town walls as well, in bed with the widow of a knight slain during the first battle. All three dragons were outside the town, in fields beyond the encampments. Though attempts were made to wake Ulf White from his drunken slumber, he proved impossible to rouse. Infamously, he rolled under a table and snored through the entire battle. Hard Hugh Hammer was quicker to respond. Half-dressed, he rushed down the steps to the yard, calling for his hammer, his armour, and a horse, so he might ride out and mount Vermithor. His men rushed to obey, even as sea smoke set the stables ablaze. But Lord John Roxton had claimed Lord Footley's bedchamber along with Lord Footley's wife, and was already in the yard. When he spied Hard Hugh, Roxton saw his chance and said, "Lord Hammer, my condolences." Hammer turned, glowering. "For what?" he demanded. "You died in the battle," Bold John replied, drawing Orphan Maker and thrusting deep into Hammer's belly, before opening the bastard from groin to throat. A dozen of Hard Hugh's men came running in time to see him die. Even a Valyrian steel blade like Orphan Maker little avails a man when it is 1 against 10. Bold John Roxton slew 3 before he was slain in turn. It is said that he died when his foot slipped on a coil of Hugh Hammer's entrails, but perhaps that detail is too perfectly ironic to be true. 3 conflicting accounts exist as to the manner of death of Prince Daeron Targaryen. The best known claims that the prince stumbled from his pavilion with his nightclothes afire, only to be cut down by the meerish sellsword Black Trombo, who smashed his face in with a swing of his spiked morning star. This version was the one preferred by Black Trombo, who told it far and wide. The second version is more or less the same, save that the prince was killed with a sword, not a morning star, and his slayer was not Black Trombo, but some unknown man-at-arms who, like as not, did not even realize whom he had killed. In the third alternative, the brave boy, known as Daeron the Daring, did not even make it out at all, but died when his burning pavilion collapsed upon him. That is the version preferred by Munkin's True Telling, and by us. Whatever the manner of his death, it is beyond dispute that Daeron Targaryen, youngest son of King Viserys I by Queen Alicent, died at the Second Battle of Tumbleton. The feigned princes who appeared during the reign of Aegon III, using his name, have been conclusively shown to be impostors. In the sky above, Adam Valerian could see the battle turning into a rout below him. 2 of the 3 enemy dragon riders were dead, but he would have had no way of knowing that. He could doubtless see the enemy dragons, however. Unchained, they were kept beyond the town walls, free to fly and hunt as they would. Silverwing and Vermithor oft coiled about one another in the fields south of Tumbleton, whilst Tessarion slept and fed in Prince Daeron's camp to the west of the town, not 100 yards from his pavilion. Dragons are creatures of fire and blood, and all 3 roused as the battle bloomed around them. A crossbowman let fly a bolt at Silverwing, we are told, and 20 mounted knights closed on Vermithor with sword and lance and axe, hoping to dispatch the beast whilst he was still half asleep and on the ground. They paid for that folly with their lives. Elsewhere on the field, Tessarion threw herself into the air, shrieking and spitting flame, and Adam Valerian turned sea smoke to meet her. A dragon's scales are largely, though not entirely, impervious to flame. They protect the more vulnerable flesh and musculature beneath. As a dragon ages, its scales thicken and grow harder, affording even more protection, even as its flames burn hotter and fiercer. Where the flames of a hatchling can set straw aflame, the flames of Balerion or Vhagar in the fullness of their power could and did melt steel and stone. When 2 dragons meet in mortal combat, therefore, they will oft employ weapons other than their flame. Claws black as iron, long as swords and sharp as razors, jaws so powerful they can crunch through even a knight's steel plate, tails like whips whose lashing blows have been known to smash wagons to splinters, break the spine of heavy destriers, and send men flying 50 feet in the air. The battle between Tessarion and Sea Smoke was different. History calls the struggle between King Aegon II and his half-sister Rhaenyra the Dance of the Dragons. But only at Tumbleton did the dragons ever truly dance. Tessarion and Sea Smoke were young dragons, nimbler in the air than their older kin. Time and time again they rushed one another, only to have one or the other veer away at the last instant. Soaring like eagles, stooping like hawks, they circled, snapping and roaring, spitting fire, but never closing. Once the Blue Queen vanished into a bank of cloud, only to reappear an instant later, diving on Sea Smoke from behind to scorch his tail with a burst of cobalt flame. Meanwhile, Sea Smoke rolled and banked and looped. One instant he would be below his foe, and suddenly he would twist in the sky and come around behind her. Higher and higher the two dragons flew, as hundreds watched from the roofs of Tumbleton. One such said afterward that the flight of Tassarian and Sea Smoke seemed more mating dance than battle. Perhaps it was. The dance ended when Vermithor rose roaring into the sky. Almost 100 years old and as large as the two young dragons put together, the bronze dragon with the great tan wings was in a rage as he took flight, with blood smoking from 12 wounds. Riderless, he knew not friend from foe, so he loosed his wrath on all, spitting flame to right and left, turning savagely on any man who dared to fling a spear in his direction. One knight tried to flee before him, only to have Vermithor snatch him up in his jaws, even as his horse galloped on. Lords Piper and Deddings, seated together atop a low rise, burned with their squires, servants, and sworn shields when the Bronze Fury chanced to take note of them. An instant later, Sea Smoke fell upon him. Alone of the four dragons on the field that day, Sea Smoke had a rider. Sir Adam Valerian had come to prove his loyalty by destroying the two betrayers and their dragons. And here was one beneath him, attacking the men who had joined him for this fight. He must have felt duty-bound to protect them, though surely he knew in his heart that his Sea Smoke could not match the older dragon. This was no dance, but a fight to the death. Vermithor had been flying no more than 20 feet above the battle when Sea Smoke slammed into him from above, driving him shrieking into the mud. Men and boys ran in terror or were crushed as the two dragons rolled and tore at one another. Tails snapped and wings beat at the air, but the beasts were so entangled that neither was able to break free. Benjikut Blackwood watched the struggle from atop his horse 50 yards away. Vermithor's size and weight were too much for Sea Smoke to contend with, Lord Blackwood told Grand Maester Munken many years later, and he would surely have torn the silver-grey dragon to pieces, if Tassarion had not fallen from the sky at that very moment to join the fight. Who can know the heart of a dragon? Was it simple bloodlust that drove the Blue Queen to attack? Did the she-dragon come to help one of the combatants? If so, which? Some will claim that the bond between a dragon and dragon rider runs so deep that the beast shares his master's loves and hates. But who was the ally here? And who the enemy? Does a riderless dragon know friend from foe? We shall never know the answers to those questions. All that history tells us is that 3 dragons fought amidst the mud and blood and smoke of 2nd Tumbleton. Sea Smoke was first to die, when Vermithor locked his teeth into his neck and ripped his head off. Afterward the bronze dragon tried to take flight, with his prize still in his jaws, but his tattered wings could not lift his weight. After a moment, he collapsed and died. Tassarion, the Blue Queen, lasted until sunset. Thrice she tried to regain the sky, and thrice failed. By late afternoon she seemed to be in pain, so Lord Blackwood summoned his best archer, a longbowman, known as Billy Burley, who took up a position 100 yards away, beyond the range of the dying dragon's fires, and sent 3 shafts into her eye as she lay helpless on the ground. By dusk, the fighting was done. Though the Riverlords lost less than 100 men, whilst cutting down more than 1,000 of the men from Old Town and the Reach, 2nd Tumbleton could not be accounted a complete victory for the attackers, as they failed to take the town. Tumbleton's walls were still intact, and once the king's men had fallen back inside and closed their gates, the queen's forces had no way to make a breach, lacking both siege equipment and dragons. Even so, they wreaked great slaughter on their confused and disorganized foes, fired their tents, burned or captured almost all their wagons, fodder and provisions, made off with 3/4 of their war horses, slew their prince, and put an end to 2 of the king's dragons. At moonrise, the river lords abandoned the field to the carrion crows, fading back into the hills. One of them, the boy Ben Blackwood, carried with him the broken body of Sir Adam Valerian, found dead beside his dragon. His bones would rest at Raventree Hall for 8 years, but in 138 AC his brother Alan would have them returned to Driftmark and entombed in Hull, the town of his birth. On his tomb is engraved a single word, Loyal. Its ornate letters are supported by carvings of a seahorse and a mouse. On the morning after the battle, the conquerors of Tumbleton looked out from the town walls to find their foes gone. The dead were strewn all around the city, and amongst them sprawled the carcasses of three dragons. One remained. Silverwing, good Queen Alisande's mount in days of old, had taken to the sky as the carnage began, circling the battlefield for hours, soaring on the hot winds rising from the fires below. Only after dark did she descend, to land beside her slain cousins. Later, singers would tell of how she thrice lifted Vermithor's wing with her nose, as if to make him fly again. But this is most like a fable. The rising sun would find her flapping listlessly across the field, feeding on the burned remains of horses, men, and oxen. 8 of the 13 caltrops lay dead, amongst them Lord Owen Fossaway, Mark Ambrose, and bold John Roxton. Richard Rodden had taken an arrow to the neck and would die the next day. 4 of the plotters remained, amongst them Sir Hobart Hightower and Lord Unwin Peak. And though Hard Hugh Hammer had died and his dreams of kingship with him, the second betrayer remained. Ulf White had woken from his drunken sleep to find himself the last dragon rider and possessed of the last dragon. "The hammer's dead, and your boy as well," he is purported to have told Lord Peak. "All you got left is me." When Lord Peak asked him his intentions, White replied, "We march, just how you want it. You take the city, I'll take the bloody throne. How's that?" The next morning, Sir Hobart Hightower called upon him to thrash out the details of their assault upon King's Landing. He brought with him 2 casks of wine as a gift, one of Dornish red and one of Arbor gold. Though Ulf the Sot had never tasted a wine he did not like, he was known to be partial to the sweeter vintages. No doubt Sir Hobart hoped to sip the sour red, whilst Lord Ulf quaffed down the Arbor gold. Yet something about Hightower's manner. He was sweating and stammering and too hearty by half, the squire who served them testified later, pricked White's suspicions. Wary, he commanded that the Dornish red be set aside for later, and insisted Sir Hobart share the Arbor gold with him. History has little good to say about Sir Hobart Hightower, but no man can question the manner of his death. Rather than betray his fellow caltrops, he let the squire fill his cup, drank deep, and asked for more. Once he saw Hightower drink, Ulf the Sot lived up to his name, putting down 3 cups before he began to yawn. The poison in the wine was a gentle one. When Lord Ulf went to sleep, never to awaken, Sir Hobart lurched to his feet and tried to make himself retch, but too late. His heart stopped within the hour. "No man ever feared Sir Hobart's sword," Mushroom says of him, "but his wine-cup was deadlier than Valyrian steel." Afterward, Lord Unwin Peak offered 1,000 golden dragons to any knight of noble birth who could claim Silverwing. 3 men came forth. When the first had his arm torn off and the second burned to death, the third man reconsidered. By that time, Peak's army, the remnants of the great host that Prince Darren and Lord Ormond Hightower had led all the way from Old Town, was falling to pieces, as deserters fled Tumbleton by the score, with all the plunder they could carry. Bowing to defeat, Lord Unwin summoned his lords and sergeants and ordered a retreat. The accused turncloak Adam Valerian, born Adam of Hull, had saved King's Landing from the Queen's foes, at the cost of his own life. Yet the Queen knew nothing of his valour. Rhaenyra's flight from King's Landing had been beset with difficulty. At Rosby she found the castle gates barred at her approach, by the command of the young woman whose claim she had passed over in favour of a younger brother. Young Lord Stokeworth's castellan granted her hospitality, but only for a night. "They will come for you," he warned the Queen, "and I do not have the power to resist them." 1/2 of her gold cloaks deserted on the road, and one night her camp was attacked by broken men. Though her knights beat off the attackers, Sir Balon Birch was felled by an arrow, and Sir Lionel Bentley, a young knight of the Queen's Guard, suffered a blow to the head that cracked his helm. He perished, raving, the following day. The Queen pressed on toward Duskendale. House Darklyn had been amongst Rhaenyra's strongest supporters, but the cost of that loyalty had been high. Lord Gunther had lost his life in the Queen's service, as had his uncle Stefan. Duskendale itself had been sacked by Sir Criston Cole. Small wonder, then, that Lord Gunther's widow was less than overjoyed when Her Grace appeared at her gates. Only the intercession of Sir Harold Dark persuaded Lady Meredith to allow the Queen within her walls at all. The Darks were distant kin to the Darklins, and Sir Harold had once served as a squire to the late Sir Stefan, and only upon the condition that she would not remain for long. Once safely behind the walls of the Dun Fort, overlooking the harbour, Rhaenyra commanded Lady Darklin's maester to send word to Grand Maester Gerardus on Dragonstone, asking that a ship be sent at once to take her home. 3 ravens flew, the town chronicles assert. Yet, as the days passed, no ship appeared. Nor did any reply return from Gerardus on Dragonstone, to the Queen's fury. Once again she began to question her Grand Maester's loyalty. The Queen had better fortune elsewhere. From Winterfell, Craigan Stark wrote to say that he would bring a host south as soon as he could, but warned that it would take some time to gather his men. "For my realms are large, and with winter upon us, we must needs bring in our last harvest or starve when the snows come to stay." The Northman promised the Queen 10,000 men, younger and fiercer than my winter wolves. The Maiden of the Vale promised aid as well, when she replied from her winter castle, the Gates of the Moon. But with the mountain passes closed by snow, her knights would need to come by sea. If House Valerian would send its ships to Gulltown, Lady Jane wrote, she would dispatch an army to Duskendale at once. If not, she must needs hire ships from Braavos and Pentos, and for that she would need coin. Queen Rhaenyra had neither gold nor ships. When she had sent Lord Corlys to the dungeons, she had lost her fleet, and she had fled King's Landing in terror of her life without so much as a coin. Despairing and fearful, Her Grace walked the castle battlements of Duskendale weeping, growing ever more grey and haggard. She could not sleep and would not eat, nor would she suffer to be parted from Prince Aegon, her last living son. Day and night the boy remained by her side, like a small pale shadow. When Lady Meredith made it plain that the Queen had overstayed her welcome, Rhaenyra was forced to sell her crown, to raise the coin to buy passage on a Braavosi merchantman, the Violand. Sir Harold Dark urged her to seek refuge with Lady Arryn in the Vale, whilst Sir Medric Manderley tried to persuade her to accompany him and his brother Sir Torren back to White Harbour. But Her Grace refused them both. She was adamant on returning to Dragonstone. There she would find dragon's eggs, she told her loyalists. She must have another dragon, or all was lost. Strong winds pushed the Violand closer to the shores of Driftmark than the Queen might have wished, and thrice she passed within hailing distance of the Sea Snake's warships, but Rhaenyra took care to keep well out of sight. Finally the Braavosi put into the harbour below the Dragonmont on the eventide. The Queen had sent a raven from Duskendale to give notice of her coming, and found an escort waiting as she disembarked with her son Aegon, her ladies, and 3 Queensguard knights. The gold cloaks who had ridden with her from King's Landing stayed at Duskendale, whilst the Manderleys remained aboard the Violand, bound for White Harbour. It was raining when the Queen's party came ashore, and hardly a face was to be seen about the port. Even the dockside brothels appeared dark and deserted, but Her Grace took no notice. Sick in body and spirit, broken by betrayal, Rhaenyra Targaryen wanted only to return to her own seat, where she imagined that she and her son would be safe. Little did the Queen know that she was about to suffer her last and most grievous treachery. Her escort, 40 strong, was commanded by Sir Alfred Broom, one of the men left behind when Rhaenyra had launched her attack upon King's Landing. Broom was the most senior of the knights at Dragonstone, having joined the garrison during the reign of the old king. As such, he had expected to be named as Castellan when Rhaenyra went forth to seize the Iron Throne. But Sir Alfred's sullen disposition and sour manner inspired neither affection nor trust, Mushroom tells us, so the Queen had passed him over in favour of the more affable Sir Robert Quince. When Rhaenyra asked why Sir Robert had not come to meet her, Sir Alfred replied that the Queen would be seeing